I propose to end much more simplistically than even up to this point. And by simplistic, I mean just that, simply. I want to just say two things that I think are the two major keys to maintaining a marriage. I want to say them as simply as I know how and with all the conviction I possess, because I believe after 18 or 19 years working with couples and with families, that if these two things are observed, both of them, that 90% of the divorces would not be, and that maybe 100%, how do I know, of the problems we face, nothing's going to eliminate all of them because all of our homes are under pressure, but I think these two things are utterly, utterly indispensable. And I'd like to just begin. Number one, keep on dating. That's number one. Now, I'm going to elaborate a little bit, obviously, but number one is keep on dating. If I had to choose either of these two, this greatly minimizes number two, but I would say this, keep on dating. Whenever you find a home that's in trouble, whenever you find a divorce, whenever you find a home that is in rocky times, the one thing that is almost always missing is a dating mentality. Now, I'm going to try not to be profusely redundant tonight because there are enough tapes available. If there's anything by some sadistic twist of the mind you may want to hear again, you can play it again. But I do want to say that it's utterly fundamental to keep in mind that there is a domestic personality and there is a social personality. The social personality is what you have striven to become. Strived, you've worked at it. And you have become that social personality. The domestic personality is what you do when you go home and leave your brain at the office, when you just automatically begin reproducing your own home environment. That's the domestic personality. And they really are very, very different. And the couples who keep on dating, or even when just one of them does, goes a long way toward alleviating the problems that often occur. Now, one illustration I want to give that I really struggle with, because I know it says it so well, and yet I'm not sure I can draw it out. It's a typical scene. I try to be very careful about ever, as you know, on Sunday morning, I never mention a counseling situation. But the one I'm going to share now as an illustration of this first thing is just, to me, just so precisely to the point that... I've seen it perhaps 100, maybe 200 times over the last 15 or 20 years, but it's a typical triangle. Now, as some of you know, a typical triangle often is composed of two men and one woman, or in some cases, two women and one man. This particular triangle involves two women and one man. This young lady, this was in another community, worked in this gentleman's office. He was a very predominant businessman of this community, of this particular community, and he was having trouble in his marriage. She was having trouble in her marriage. She became very vulnerable, very lonely, very vulnerable. Most extracurricular affairs are due not to evil, dirty people, but just loneliness and foolishness, just not being careful enough and aware enough. At any rate, one day at the office, in some particular area of the office, they had an affair, quote unquote. She decided after that to save her marriage. Her husband was out of state. She called him, arranged to have him come back. She came to me and she said this. She said, I want to rebuild my marriage very badly. But she said, the problem I have is that I have had this, as she called it, one night stand. It was actually a one afternoon stand, though I think they're basically the same. And she said, it was such an exciting sexual experience that I'm not sure I can go back to old what's his name. Now, number one, always in extracurricular sexual activity where no maturation is required, the emotions are so taut and so readily accessible and so vulnerable to stimulation that they always are more exciting, and they don't get that exciting until two people grow up together and build that kind of response in a great marriage. But that was her response, that this guy was just absolutely out of this world. They always are. And she always is. And he always did, according to her, the one time. Well, at any rate, a few months later, someone came into my office whom I did not know, made an appointment, and sat down and began discussing how bad her marriage was. She said, my husband, she said, now, I'm just going to tell you straight out that the problem in our marriage is sexual. My husband is a dud. She said, now, I'm going to tell you, my husband's a very prominent businessman in this town. And would you believe it was the same guy? And the difference is the difference between the social personality and the domestic personality. Everybody is a dud while they're trying to grow up. And it's someone who will help them grow up, and they who will recognize that you really have to use your mind. You can't leave your brain at the office or at the altar and go home. Because when we go home, we do tend to reproduce the pathological orientations of our childhood, and most homes from about the seventh year of marriage on tend, without the use of the brain, to be a reproduction of the adult's childhood home. So keep on dating. Keep on dating. How much different would courtesy be? How much difference is courtesy in a home where a couple is always dating? How much different is just appearance? I heard a man in Ohio say not long ago, he said, the first thing that went wrong in my marriage were her underclothes. I said, what do you mean? He said, I knew one day or one night when she felt no need at all to look attractive to me, that there was a problem. I heard someone say later that any time there's a rubber band along here and pants hanging down here, you know either that he has not gotten tenure yet or or that basically there is a lack of dating in the relationship. And most people who go looking do not go looking because they're not in love with the person they're married to. Most people who go looking because they do not feel affirmed in the home. And that's because people quit dating. And I know we all do to some degree, but the happier the home, the more degree of cerebral involvement in the dating relationship. For instance, take just for instance foreplay, which I mentioned the other day. One of the most common problems in sex in marriage is that once a couple gets married, if they want to have sex, pow! They jump in bed, they have sex. Before they got married, they had foreplay till steam was coming out of everybody's ears and their eyes were glassy and about to fall out. But after marriage, they give that up for Lent. And then all of a sudden, they're wondering, what's happened to our relationship? I'm saying that fundamentally, the single most important rule in the care and maintenance of a good marriage, how to keep a good thing going, is to keep on dating. Keep on dating. Courtesy. Appearance. I saw a cartoon the other day. An unshaved man in a t-shirt was standing with soap all over his face, and his wife was in the room with him with her hair up in curlers and a robe on, and he said, Gladys, we've got to stop seeing each other like this. And in a sense, that's really true. Now, obviously, there ought to be some latitude for just being home. But when was the last time? Here's the problem. You see, husbands think the wives ought to wear what I call the black nighty syndrome. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think there's all sorts of nice things can be added to a relationship when people dress for one another, whether it's black nighties or what have you. But when was the last time you ever came in the house without taking your tie off first and your coat? Look great for everybody at the office. Come in and it's a different ball game. When was the last time when he was coming home you just comb your hair and put on some lipstick and just tried to say to him, you're so important to me that I'm still wooing you. I'm still dating. There's a sense of affection. There's a sense of affirmation. There is something that would never be lost in most marriages if we never stopped dating. I think it is awfully important to always be dating. The thing that's helped me are these three questions, if you want to write them down. Number one, if we were still dating, how would I act? You'll find that by and large, it's very different from how you've acted when you stop dating. How would I act if we were still dating? Would I still open a door? Now, I do that now. I open a door if I think somebody's watching. If there's nobody watching, she can handle it on her own. We've come that far. But that's a whole lot further than a lot of people pull the chair out for. Now, that's hard. Because my wife, when she goes into a restaurant, she's looking at everything in sight. And there I am holding the chair out while she's looking around, you know. And I'm embarrassed being nice anyway. You know, everybody's embarrassed when they're nice. And here I'm holding this chair. And she, look at those pretty flowers. Oh, do you know that couple over there? And she's looking all over the place. And I push the chair up under her. And she she plops down in it. It's a two-sided problem. People have got to work together on it. But how would I act? How would I act? We mentioned a delicate thing here because I've only touched on it in a very cursory way, this thing of loyalty and not running around with somebody else. I have tried to say that some of the best marriages are where this has happened and people have put it back together and they've loved and honored each other and gotten back in the parade. But you see, there's nothing more detrimental to a marriage. There is nothing that causes more anguish in a marriage than unfaithfulness. I'm talking about sexual unfaithfulness. But the thing that I'm dealing with it from this perspective, or at least what I'm trying to say about it from tonight's perspective, is that if you were still dating, that would never happen. It's when we take someone for granted, or they take us for granted, and we stop dating, then there is the need to always be dating and always be have someone else dating you, that something begins to take over that brings a relationship or a lack of relationship, a break in the marriage that is lethal, that very often, most often, is lethal. How would I act? How would I act? Last week I mentioned just basically or quickly to develop a sense of humor. Let me touch on that again from this perspective. Most couples who date are able to laugh about a lot of things. But when couples quit dating, especially those that really love each other, especially those that have a good marriage, they tend more than anyone else to relapse into the domestic personality, to basically reproduce their own early home environment. And very often that's a home environment that did not have very much joy in it. Couples who keep on dating keep on cultivating a sense of humor. I mentioned Webster's definition of humor, a state of mind, a flexibility, an ability to perceive absurdities. And so much of what takes the heart out of our home, or at least the heart out of the immediacy of our home, is really funny, if we could just laugh at ourselves. It has been suggested that when man is confronted with stress, he is basically still a jungle animal with two basic alternatives. He can fight or flight. There's fight or flight. There's a third, laughter, especially at oneself. Hugh Misseldine, by the way, he has an excellent book out now on this inner child syndrome, which I can't think of the name of. But he says, we think of, for instance, cruelly and oppressed people, oppressed ethnic groups, we're likely to attribute their survival to their different cultural strengths. He says, for instance, we talk about the fight of the Irish, or the genius of the Jews, or the long-suffering good nature of the blacks? He says no. That behaviorally, the survival instinct they develop is a sense of humor. And I think he's right. Some years ago, it may still be going on now, there was in the Parade magazine, there was a list of my favorite jokes, and some comedian always gave his favorite jokes. I used to like to read the autobiographical part of that, not so much the jokes, but the autobiographical part. And the interesting thing to me is that half the comedians in this country come out of Brooklyn or the Bronx. Wonder what that means about Brooklyn or the Bronx. It probably means you've got to learn to laugh. You've got to find the funny side. You've got to find the paradoxical side, or what was Webster's word, if I can find it, to be able to perceive the absurdity, the absurd. I heard an East European joke the other day. One neighbor says to the other, I heard Borsky has been sent to Siberia. Oh, why? Because he called the village commissar an idiot. And why did they send him to Siberia for that? Number one was because they said he was not patriotic enough, and secondly, because he revealed a state secret. The village commissar is an idiot. People have learned to survive by developing a sense of humor. By far, the majority of the time when you sit down with a home in anguish, you will find rather ludicrous, if not basically inconsequential, data that at one point in a dating relationship would have been laughed at, but now you're just like your mother, and you're just like your father, and they're probably both right. Because once the brain is left at the office or left at the altar, we do tend to reproduce that environment. But a sense of humor. I'm talking about now the question, how would I act? Well, if I were still dating, I wouldn't be so uptight about how everything was flowing in my direction. I wouldn't be so tuned in to how I could achieve everything for me. And I would still be able to laugh at some things. I would also have a deeper understanding about what commitment is all about. I believe in commitment. I think it's something that is utterly indispensable in our lives. Someone asked Margaret Mead some time ago what she considered to be the most lethal, frightening aspect of American society. And she said this, that so many Americans today are getting married believing that it's temporary. So many Americans are marrying today believing that it's temporary. It's not temporary. It's for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, as long as you both shall live. And if that one blows up in your face, then do that with the next one. But it's not temporary. John Wesley, 200 years ago, said about faith, we've got to be singular or be damned. And I think that's true in marriage. To make a commitment and murder the alternatives. Everybody finds attraction in other people. But to murder the alternatives, to burn the ships in the harbor like Caesar did, and there's no retreat, to see this thing through. Now, if I were still dating, I'd still have that mentality. The whole time I was preparing this, I kept thinking of a guy, a good friend of mine to this day, but I knew him well in college. His name was Morris. Her name was Marcia. She was engaged to somebody else, which didn't bother him all that much. I can still see him daily around that campus, traipsing around behind her, convincing her that he was the only person for her life. And he did finally convince her that the only way she was going to get rid of him was to marry him. And so she married him. To this very day, he is still hard at work convincing her that he's the only guy for her. They're still dating. The first question is, how would I act in my life, in my home, if we were not married and we were dating? The second question is, how would I look? That needs very little elaboration. I just say it. How would I look? Would I take any better care of myself? Would I, if they were walking into my house to pick me up for a date, would I be any more affirming physically than I already am? Now, that doesn't mean less wrinkles, and it doesn't mean less to squeeze. Wasn't that said diplomatically? It means, what would I do to really say, I'm still interested in you? How would I look? I made a comment two or three Wednesday nights ago that one of the single most disorienting and destructive factors today in getting married are people who are living together. You find very few people who make good marriages who live together, especially for long lengths of time. Now, after it becomes long enough to be common law, whatever that is, and they're really married in a sense, that's a different thing. But I'm talking about 6 months, a year. The problem is they never stop dating. And once having convinced themselves that they now know who each other is and how compatible they are and how well they function together on all levels, that couple, more than any other, when they get married, the domestic personality takes over very quickly. They stop dating and the whole thing tends to collapse. And the basic problem is just the fact that they thought they were married, but they never stopped dating. Now, when I said that, somebody thought, in fact, they told me, they thought I was advocating that people shouldn't get married and just live together. No, that's not what I'm advocating. What I'm saying is that be like they are in the sense that we are married. Tied, the knot is tied, and we are committed. But I've got to remember how I look. And while I've got a right to be dirty, and when I come home, you come home, and I'm cleaning the bathroom or washing the dog, I need some latitude. But one of the greatest needs in the home today are for people just to say to one another, do you notice how important I think you are? I'm not kidding you. I'm not kidding you. How would I act? How would I look? And the third essential question is, how would I listen? I find that in my home, when I'm practicing dating, I listen on a whole different level. See, that's the way I conned her into marrying me anyway. She thought I was interested in what she had to say. And I find that when I get back to that, the relationship, everything is affected by how much I date in my relationship. Of course, that's what the whole essence of sex was, as I tried to talk about how critical sex was. It is an effort to constantly, I'm talking now about marriage, it is an effort constantly to affirm someone else. And if they will affirm me, it becomes very reciprocal, with a high degree of reciprocal interaction and positive feedback, rather than the negative feedback that comes when we just do our own thing. You knew when you married me I was a bum. I still want to know what the women's counterpart to that is. Does anybody know? In Australia they call them Sallies, but that just doesn't do it for me. Okay. How do I act? How do I look? How do I listen? That's the important thing. You cannot get married and leave your brain at the altar. I am personally convinced. Let me read it as I've written it down. I am personally convinced that this key would eliminate 80 to 90% of marital strife. I think it would eliminate virtually everything except pathological or psychotic problems and overly neurotic problems. I think it would eliminate... See, most of the people I see, you've got to understand this. Most of the people I see, there's nothing wrong with their marriage. Except this. That they quit being the person the guy or gal fell in love with. I'm serious. Just now, a lot of much more competent clinical people than I see different types of people. I'm just saying that the vast preponderance of people I see, which I have a feeling is a good cross-section of the society, they stop being the person the other one fell in love with, and that's the genesis of the marriage. Someone said, or the problem, someone said, If people behaved in marriage, if men behaved in marriage the way they did before they got married, half the divorces would cease to occur. And someone added to that, and there would be twice as many bankruptcies. And that's probably true. Number one, keep on dating. I hate to leave that. I'm having trouble getting away from it. Because if someone were to say to me, I'll give you one statement to say to the American family. Keep on dating. It's what I'd say. Keep on dating. Keep on cultivating dating. Keep on working at dating. I know a couple right now. They are in their late 70s. They have never stopped courting. They are wildly in love. They never stopped dating. It's the answer to so many, simplistic, but the answer to so many problems. Someone in the talk back the other evening raised the question about children. Well, we haven't talked about children. I left singles out. Just so many things. You know, I've left everything out about marriage. Why should I try to get into all the other? It's such a complex, frustrating thing. But they said, what is the answer to raising children? Well, how would I know? I've got some. You've got to ask somebody who doesn't have any to get an answer on that. But I did share this. Someone has said, and I agree with this, that the three most important things you can do for your child is, number one, love their mother or love their father. Number two, wrestle with them on the floor. And number three, say, these are the rules of our house. This is what we do, and that means you. But see, number one is keep on dating. You want to help your children? Love their mother. Love their father. Keep on dating. Number two, finally, secondly, continually reevaluate priorities. Sounds innocent, sounds easy, but it ain't. Continue to reevaluate priorities. Let me give you the statistics on this. They come from the 1970 census, if you want to check this out. In this country today, or in 1970, two out of every four homes ended in divorce. Two out of every four homes ended in divorce. Excuse me. And the main reason given for that was economic overextension. Another way of putting that is disheveled priorities. It begins the very first day of marriage. The first thing a new couple wants when they get married is furniture at least as good as their parents. What does the TV ad? Can you afford this, Ethan Allen furniture? Why, Mother, you've always told us that. Well, they want as good a furniture, they want as nice a car, and will wait at least a month for as nice a home. You see, that is a rudimentary problem in early marriage. Getting that nicer home has pretty well been eliminated by the times. But the furniture and the car has not been. And it goes on from there that as we get into these various cycles, when I talked about the sexual responses and the diminishing of emotional titillation and the commensurate problems with that as we start the process of maturity, couples begin buying. The idea being what this home needs is a new color TV set. What this home needs is a speedboat. And we go right on down the line until finally we have bought ourselves into a corner. And the 1970 census says the major cause for divorce in America is economic overextension. I'm saying that's only symptomatic. It's symptomatic of the fact that our priorities are so disheveled. John Lotz, the basketball coach, spoke here this summer. He's a member of our church. And John told the story of Soren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard's statement on America, I think it's an excellent statement. Kierkegaard said, the trouble with America He says, it's like someone had gone into a major department store one evening while everybody was out and had taken all the expensive labels and put them on all the cheap merchandise and all the cheap labels on the expensive merchandise. And Kierkegaard, the philosopher, said that we come back into the store the next day and we expect to buy everything that's really costly in the cheapest possible way. And everything that's really cheap, we'll trade our souls for it. That's true. Pessimistic, but it's true. Today, across our land, the things that don't really matter, that don't really turn it around, don't really shape it up and change it, we'll mortgage our souls for. But the principles, the integrity, the commitment, things that you really pay through the nose for, we hope to buy as cheaply as we can possibly get them. Now, the 1970 census shows that 2 out of every 4 homes ends in divorce, except, according to the census, if you want to check it out, where husbands and wives go to church together regularly. I said, here it comes. Been waiting 6 weeks, and I knew it'd get here. I share this with every couple I marry and always feel very self-conscious about it because it is suspect, to say the least. But the 1970 census shows that when a man and wife go to church, any church, synagogue, it does not matter where they go. Sorry about that for you Baptists. The census shows that if they go to church together, the divorce rate drops to one divorce in 500. Now, I remember saying that in a group here at church one time, and immediately I was cornered and somebody said, my husband and I went to church together every Sunday, and we got a divorce. Said one in 500. You know, bound to show up somewhere. One in 500. All right, what does that mean? Does that mean when you walk through the door, God gives you a white hat and you're good? No. We have people who walk through that door every Sunday who are possibly the biggest hypocrites in town. I don't judge them because I have so much trouble with that myself. But walking in the door doesn't make you a good guy. Why, you can come to church every Sunday and be as phony as an $8 bill. That's not it. And it's not even theology. I know one atheist who goes to church every Sunday of the year. You want me to name the church? We have 1,200 here on Sunday. Why not? Trinity Methodist. I said, why do you go to church? Because of what it means to my family. It is a priority thing, you see. You can take all the theology out of it. Just the sheer pragmatics of a disciplined, prioritized life. Now, I don't want to take all the theology out of it. And I believe that intelligent people responding in intelligent faith, God really functions in our life. But just purely secularize it. Take out all the theology. At least here's a couple coming to church on Sunday with a sense of discipline, who are not finding something to get mad at on the month of the stewardship drive. More people get mad this month than any other month in the year. Well, I don't like that church anyway. I'm not going to tithe, pledge, or anything else. Then after it's all over, they get over it. But at any rate, here's a couple. You see, the average couple, basic church attendance runs from age 0 to 18 and starts again at age 30. Now, this church is different in that it's in a different kind of community, a young adult community. So we have tons and tons of 20-year-olds. But the average church attendance in the United States runs from 18 to 32 or 30. I want to say a very delicate thing here, and this is tremendously simplistic, though not out of line at all, or I wouldn't say it. (Laughter) I respect this, and I don't want to seem to put it down. An awfully lot of the couples who come back to church at 30, the primary reason is to save their marriage. Now, I'm not minimizing that. I think that's good, especially if they know what they're doing. That makes it even better. But most of the time, it's too little, too late. In the 6 years I've been in this church, there have been many couples who did not make it from the time I saw them in their homes until the membership Sunday before they were separated. They waited that long. What's happened? Well, when you first get married, you don't need anything. No child, no, the child doesn't have leukemia. You haven't discovered your first lump. Sunday morning is the only time you've seen each other all week. You're lying there in bed, comfortable and cozy, and you will skip this Sunday. And then the next, and then the next, and then the next. And then to justify that, we begin dragging hypocrites out of the closet that were in our church, and that's not hard to find. And then we just go through that whole routine until we've gotten completely away. But among couples who go to church together regularly, the divorce rate, according to the 1970 census, have I mentioned that? Drops to one divorce in 500, because here is a couple who at least have a sense of discipline and a commitment to priority without any theology at all. Leave it out if you want to. You see, when you come to church on Sunday morning, why, everybody knows, though you didn't know anybody else felt this way, all families have their biggest fights getting ready to go to church. Now, you thought you were the only one in town like that, but everybody, every family has their biggest knockdown dragouts getting ready to go to church. They always come to church mad at each other. Sit out and say, "Inspire me." I dare you to make me love her. I dare you. That's what I face every Sunday morning. I know that because I left my house in a big fight. So we come to church, and that night we had an inner child problem. There was some pathos, logos, some agony within me crying out for my childhood that I dumped on the one I loved the most who would take it. Nobody else would take it. Somebody else punched me right in the mouth. So I dump it on the one I love the most. And the next morning, I lie there in bed thinking what this marriage needs is a new car. No. What this marriage needs is a sense of discipline and a sense of priority. And two people who can drag themselves out of a comfortable bed and go down and expose themselves to new ideas, to new principles, to new depths of living. See, faith is a whole lot more than just navel-gazing, where we just sit around and say, "Well, I'm as good as everybody else, and I look wonderful to me." But where they expose them, you know, when you come down to church on Sunday morning, and like last Sunday. Now, everybody here had a big fight at home, with the exception of you. You come down to church, and you remember on Saturday night you had a real disagreement. You just don't remember what it was about. Most pathological arguments are like that. It's childhood stuff. You throw it out, you dump on each other and forget about it, except it adds up like rocks on a scale after a while, and it tips. But you come into church, and what are we talking about here? Hungry, starving families in Cambodia. And wait a minute, don't minimize this. You can't believe how far that goes to dealing with picky little problems in the home. I've had all kind of car trouble this week. If it weren't for those people in Cambodia, I'd be going bananas. But I look at that thing and I think, boy, aren't I blessed? Aren't I blessed? To constantly reassess one's priorities. Am I putting first things first? And I consider dating part of that priority list. Am I putting second things second? There's nothing wrong with a 16th thing in 16th place. And a 16th thing in 16th place is just as fun as a 16th place in first place, without all the lethalness. And when I have my ninth place things in ninth place, it's just like one's vertebrae. If you've got one thing out of place, you're a cripple. And I think to keep on dating and to constantly reassess one's priorities, which means each other and dating and time together and where we put our time and where we put our money and where we put our energy, constantly reassess one's priorities. This is the critical thing. So, as I bring this to a conclusion, at least for this session, I have tried to share with you what I've tried to share because though it lifts me up for real flack, and in real truth, I knew that in order to help 20, I would seriously hurt one who would not have been hurt at all, because people try to generally apply everything you say to their situation, sometimes much too indiscriminately. But I really wanted to share these things with you throughout these evenings, because I have found things in my own life and in my own marriage and in my own counseling that has really helped me. And I just try to pass that on. But to bring it to summation, keep on dating and keep on checking priorities, because if you do that, there is a chance of discovering realities and hope and beauty that you're not going to find in anyone else, anywhere else. I heard a story yesterday that just really spoke to me at this point, and I'd just like to wrap up these six evenings by sharing it with you. It's very brief. Sonny Scott, David Scott's at First Methodist, a marvelous preacher, was preaching up in High Springs in a retreat. He told it. Scott's told about a farmer who just got fed up, discouraged, depressed. He had had it with his farm. Called out a real estate man. He said, I want to put this place on the market. I want to sell it. I want to get rid of it. The real estate man spent an hour walking around the place making notations to put in the ads to ship around all over the country, you know, where people want to buy the farms. He came back the next day with a description of the place. The house was beautiful. Pre-Civil War, good maintenance, had some work to be done, but was in very good condition. The fields were partly grown up, but some work would correct them. The place was completely fenced, though some fence needed to be mended. There were beautiful woods. There was a lovely meadow. There was a beautiful stream, some junk in it, but it was a beautiful stream. And he went on to describe it the way they were going to publicize it around the country. And he said, if you'll sign right here, we'll have a commitment. The old farmer read it, handed it back to him, and said, tear it up. He said, why? He said, I've been looking for a farm just like that all my life. And now that I've got it, I'm not going to let you have it. That's what I've been trying to say for 6 weeks. I'd like to ask you tonight, if you would, to just take a few moments privately to just think about your marriage or your life as a single parent or person. And feel you free to use the altar to pray if you would like, or to pray in your seat, or just meditate in your seat. And when you've finished, just slip quietly out of the building for those who might like to stay for a while longer. And if you as a family can make a commitment or a new commitment or a renewed commitment or just within your own soul, do that tonight, to go back out and fix that fence and fix up that old house. And it's probably what you've been looking for all your life. And there's just no need to walk away from it, hoping it's somewhere else. So let's do that now. Just remain seated or come forward for a time of prayer and meditation.